from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 2013 is all the political news today. Christie, McAuliffe, de Blasio, and more. And ready or not, 2016 is coming up over the political horizon. Political reporters Mark Halperin and John Heilman see all that. They're on it. But they're also looking back. They did it for 2008 with Game Change and all the juicy details on Sarah Palin and more. This hour on Point, their latest, Double Down. Game Changers Mark Halperin and John Heilman on 2012, 2013, and beyond with us today. You can join us on air or online. Where this conversation is always on, have you heard their latest juice on Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, Chris Christie, Mitt Romney? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York are Mark Halperin and John Heilman, co-authors of the new book on the 2012 presidential election, Double Down, Game Change 2012. They're the authors of the number one New York Times bestseller, Game Change, Obama and the Clintons, McCain and Palin and the Race of a Lifetime. That book was turned into a movie by HBO, and Double Down has already been optioned by the network. Mark Halperin is editor-at-large and a senior political analyst for Time magazine. John Heilman is national affairs editor for New York magazine. They're both political analysts for MSNBC. Mark, John, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you right here.
Hey, Tom. We're happy to be here.
Happy to have you. We're going to jump all over this book, but just take a second and look with us at what we just saw yesterday. Mark, first to you, what's big? What do we see in the 2013 elections that just took place?
I think three things. And, the biggest races obviously were the two governor's races, Governor Christie being reelected in New Jersey and Democrats taking back the governor's mansion in Virginia with Terry McAuliffe, a longtime Democratic Party figure, winning his first elective office and someone very close to the Clintons. I think, three sort of big lessons. One is the more centrist candidates won in both those races and people who make a big point of talking about working across the aisle. I think that is something that fits a lot of the mood of the country but obviously has not taken place much in Washington. Two, I think Governor Christie takes a victory, about 60% of the vote, a very large percentage of the vote from groups that Republicans have not been doing well with, and positions himself to be even more so one of the leading possible candidates for president in 2016.
I'm looking here, 20% of African Americans voting for Christie, a majority of women, a majority of the Hispanic vote in New Jersey. Yeah. Is that right?
According to the exit polls, which always are, a little bit not unscientific, but the sample may not be large enough to be conclusive about that. But clearly overperforming what Mitt Romney did, what most Republicans have done in most parts of the country of late. And that alone, along with some of his rhetoric and his formidable political skills, puts him in a position, as I said, to be considered a big candidate for 2016 on the presidential side and the Republicans. The last thing I think is in Virginia where the party – the Republican Party is going to take some lessons. The race was closer than some thought. Ken Cuccinelli, the Republican Attorney General there, is a pretty conservative guy and ran as a conservative and ran against the president's health care plan. Now, some Republicans will say, well, the race was close because it shows the Democrats' vulnerability on health care. I think the biggest problem either party faces now on the political side, not substance, on politics, is the Republican Party figuring out how do they energize conservatives while capturing the center. And Ken Cuccinelli is kind of a failed example there because he did not do in Virginia what Chris Christie was able to do in New Jersey, which is, again, energize conservatives while still being able to reach out to the center, which is the way you win most general elections in America.
Chris Christie with his centrist profile victory and a big one in New Jersey. John Heilman, take us to your wheelhouse in New York. And Bill de Blasio, if Christie is the centrist message here in a way, de Blasio is the Tale of Two Cities guy, straight up progressive, right out front with that. Does that travel beyond New York? Is that a new theme headed into 2016 that's got legs, John?
Well, look, there's no question that over the course of the last 10 years or so that the progressive activist wing of the Democratic Party, after having been somewhat sidelined during the Clinton era, has been ascendant. And you could see that in what propelled Barack Obama to help him win the Democratic nomination in 2008. In the media and online, the progressive wing is louder and more vocal and more energetic than it's been for a long time. I don't think that there's – if you think about other big cities in America, if you think about places like Chicago, places like Los Angeles, it's hard to imagine a candidate running a kind of de Blasio-like campaign and being able to prevail in those places. So I'm not sure in this case. I mean, I'm a proud New Yorker, but I'm not sure that there's much that's going to travel and it's going to be picked up by a lot of other local or let alone state or national candidates out of the Blasio race, although people on the left are certainly going to seize on it. I see it much more. This is a Democratic city. There have been Republicans who have won. Obviously, Mayor Bloomberg was a sometime Republican. Rudy Giuliani was a Republican. But after three terms of Mike Bloomberg, there was a fair amount of Bloomberg weariness by the time we got to 2013, and Bill de Blasio, as much as anything else, was able to capitalize on that and build a coalition around Democrats who wanted to take back the city from what they had seen as an excessive degree of focus on real estate development and on the wealthy here. The tale of two cities was resonant, I think, largely for parochial reasons here and was made for a powerful campaign message for him.
You may be right, but New York is a platform sort of like no other when it comes to cities, and it's out there in that prominent setting right now. I want to come back to politics 2013 and look ahead to 2016, but let's get in the Wayback Machine. Not so far back. A little time travel for a moment. That's where Double Down goes, and it's juicy. Just to get that time, that campaign back in our minds, here's June 2nd, 2011, in New Hampshire. Mitt Romney announced he was running for president. His attack on President Obama here was the beginning to a long and fairly negative campaign.
Barack Obama has failed America. When he took office, the economy was in recession, and he made it worse, and he made it last longer.
Yep, and that was just the beginning. By the fall of 12, here was President Obama attacking Mitt Romney's economic plan, saying Romney only cared about the wealthy.
When Governor Romney had his chance to let you in on his secret sauce, he didn't offer you a single new idea. It was just a retread of the same old policies that have been sticking it to the middle class for years.
Mark Halperin and John Heilman write about the 2012 campaign in Double Down. They wrote about 08 in Game Change. Mark, compare and contrast these two campaigns. You guys go for the juicy stuff. Was it here in the same way it was with Sarah Palin and all that hyper drama in 08?
Well, Tom, I mean, there clearly were a lot of exciting characters in 2008. But from our point of view, the high human drama of running for president in pretty much every cycle, particularly at a time when the country is so polarized, when there's so much interest in what Washington is doing, we found a lot of great stories about interesting people in both books and some carryover. Obviously, the Clintons are big characters, particularly Bill Clinton in Double Down and the arc of his relationship with Barack Obama. Kind of replaces what for us in Game Change was a big arc between the relationship between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. This time, how President Obama came to decide that he needed Bill Clinton's help and needed rapprochement there, I think, is a pretty rich story. And on the Republican side, you know, Governor Romney is seen in some quarters as not that compelling a figure. But we found in looking at his motivations for running, how he conducted himself during the campaign, his relationship with his family, all of that makes for pretty interesting, meaty human stories. And then you've got a lot of other compelling characters, Joe Biden and some of the Republicans both who ran, like people like Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich, pretty colorful characters. But then also a lot of the Republicans who didn't run, people like Chris Christie, people like Mitch Daniels of Indiana. These are great American political figures. And as we reveal them in Double Down, we hope seen as very compelling people grappling, you know, under this hottest of hot spotlights in American life, trying to figure out how they navigate the political but also the personal.
John Heilman, take us to that moment after what was widely understood to be a disastrous first debate for Barack Obama back in Denver, and him looking at the challenge of getting up off the mat where Mitt Romney had surprisingly left him and saying, I just don't know if I can do this. This was the president running for re-election and unsure if he could step into that debate ring and pull it off. Why?
Well, Tom, it really is one of the most compelling to us and I think one of the most dramatic episodes in the book. You know, it had been a relatively stable race with President Obama holding a narrow but solid lead over Governor Romney for most of the campaign. After the Denver debate, as you point out, the polls tightened, not as much as some people speculated they would, but it looked like, you know, there was a lot of energy on the Republican side and President Obama, a lot of panic on the Democratic side. President Obama knew he needed to perform well in the second debate at Hofstra, and he had pledged to his team that he would not screw up again as he had in Denver. And we report in the book that in the course of the debate prep for that second debate, when they were in Williamsburg, Virginia, the president suffered something like a kind of catastrophic failure in the second to last practice debate before Hofstra against Massachusetts Senator, now Secretary of State John Kerry, who was standing in for Mitt Romney. The president had a horrible debate prep where he was as bad or worse than he'd been in Denver, not just as kind of professorial and prolix and passive as he'd been, but also kind of nasty towards John Kerry, a side of Barack Obama that his advisors really feared would come out. And the following day, with literally 36 hours to go before what all of his advisors had come to see as a pivotal debate now, the team looked at his performance and said, if he does that again on stage at Hofstra, we could lose the whole election. We quote David Plouffe, his senior advisor in the White House, saying that. And so they stage with him, these four of his closest advisors sit down with him and have what they called an intervention, where they say, President Obama, what is going on inside your head? And the president says, you know, basically, I'm not wired in the way that this kind of event requires. The theatricality of politics I'm not into it. And they have to kind of talk him, carry him across the psychic chasm to get him geared up to be able to perform at the level that he needs to win that debate.
You quote the debate coach Ron Klain saying, make it fast and hammy, fast and hammy, neither of which we think of when we think of Barack Obama. His signed, sealed, delivered campaign song, Stevie Wonder, behind us right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with political reporters Mark Halperin and John Heilman about their new book, Double Down. We're looking at the 2012 campaign and 2013 and 2016 as we sit here today. They join us from New York. Big number one New York Times bestseller with Game Change, looking at the 08 campaign. HBO film came out of that. Now they're on to 2012, and there are a lot of players here who we have not seen the last of. Here's Chris Christie. Last night in Asbury Park, New Jersey, reelected Republican governor, used his victory speech to chastise Washington, D.C. for its hyper-partisanship.
Now listen, I know that if we can do this in Trenton, New Jersey, maybe the folks in Washington, D.C. should tune in their TVs right now, see how it's done.
See how it's done. You can see that rolling right on. In Double Down, Mark Halperin and John Heilman say Mitt Romney's crew looked closely at Chris Christie as a potential vice presidential candidate, along with Romney on the ticket, decided there was too much baggage. On Sunday, Mitt Romney was asked about that on NBC's Meet the Press. He disputed claims made in Double Down that the Romney campaign had had a lot of problems vetting New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Here's Romney.
Frankly, there was nothing they found that wasn't already part of the public record and that hadn't already been dealt with effectively by Chris Christie. So there was nothing new there. Chris could easily become our nominee and save our party and help get this nation on the right track again. They don't come better than Chris Christie.
Mark Halperin, Mitt Romney is surely right that Chris Christie could become the Republican nominee. He says, hey, there's nothing there. What did you find? What are you writing about in Double Down that was that the people who went out to vet Chris Christie found?
Well, Tom, we did something that's hard to do and a little bit unusual, which is we take people inside the process by which a presidential campaign, a presidential candidate scrutinizes the background of a potential running mate. The so-called vetting process is something that's usually held pretty tight. But we were interested in, first of all, who Governor Romney considered to be on his short list, who he thought of as a running mate. And there was some reporting during the campaign about what was the actual reason why Governor Christie didn't end up on the ticket. It's a pretty interesting story, and the sort of bottom line of it is Governor Romney had reservations about some of the things that his advisors turned up in the materials they got from Governor Christie and some of the public record. They were also a little concerned because Governor Christie was late in handing over some materials, whereas the other people under consideration handed things over promptly. So there were some red flags, and Governor Romney took Governor Christie off the list. But then one of his advisors, a guy named Stuart Stevens, who was kind of his chief political aide, said – In the end of June, said, you know, we need a street fighter. This campaign's not going well. right around the 4th of July holiday. He said, we need somebody who can get in the media, be a street fighter, really take it to Barack Obama, and that's Chris Christie. So Governor Romney told his advisors, you know what? We need to go back in and look at the record on Chris Christie. And what they found, as Governor Romney said, was mostly things that are part of the public record. And one of Governor Romney's advisors made that point to him during this process and said, you know, this stuff's been looked at in New Jersey. And Governor Romney said correctly, there's a big difference. No matter what state you run in, no matter how big a deal it is, if you run for president or you get put on the ticket, the scrutiny is going to be just much, much higher. And things are going to look different and things are going to come out that are different. You think about Bill Clinton and Whitewater. You think about George Bush and his drunk driving arrest. There's just things that come out, even if you run in a bigger politically competitive state. So you had Governor Romney then faced with the decision, could he go forward with Chris Christie? It was not so much any one smoking gun of things they found or questions that were unanswered. It was the totality of all the things. And Governor Romney reached a decision. Well, I don't want a distraction. I want to pick a running mate who sort of keeps the spotlight on me and doesn't create controversy. That's why he didn't pick him. The day after he got the vetting report with all these red flags in it, as we write about in the Double Down, he said no, Chris Christie, and he moved on to Paul Ryan. The implications going forward are pretty clear because now the public knows through our book some of the red flags involving his personal finances, his work as a lobbyist, questions about his medical background and history. All these things are going to be scrutinized now, as they should be. And the question is going to be for Governor Christie, if he runs for president, twofold. One is, how does he handle the investigation and the look into his background? And what are the underlying facts? And they were troubling enough for Governor Romney to say he didn't want him to be on the ticket. That doesn't mean that any of these things would keep him from being elected president, but they certainly are red flags.
John Heilman, give us the juice then. I mean, if this may come out in a way in the run-up to 2016 that's difficult for Christie, what's in there? What did Romney's crew find? What did you find? The juice, the red flags, like what, that might be difficult in the heat of a campaign?
Well, as Mark said a second ago, Tom, some of the stuff is in the public record, strictly speaking. I'll give you one example. There's a long list of things. And as Mark said, also, you know, there was the cumulative weight of these things. But I'll give you an example of something that is in the public record, but that I would bet a lot of money you don't know and that almost no one in national politics or the national media knew, which is that for a period of time, Governor Christie was a lobbyist and worked on behalf of the Securities Industry Association of America when it was lobbying to keep financial fraud out of exempted from the New Jersey State Consumer Protection Law. At the time that he was a lobbyist for that group, the group was headed by Bernie Madoff. Now, for Governor Romney's vetters, they looked at that and said, this is a 30-second ad waiting to happen. Does Mitt Romney, rich Mitt Romney, already tarred with as a Gordon Gekko-like figure because of his background at Bain Capital in private equity, could we really stand having a running mate who Democrats, through the Obama campaign, will run an ad saying this was Bernie Madoff's personal lobbyist or his corporate lobbyist? That's an example of something. Again, you could find that on Google. But again, it was something that was raised in the 2009 governor's race in New Jersey, but has had almost no airing on the national stage and is not widely known among even national political reporters. There were also a series of things related to Governor Christie's brother, who had a settlement with the SEC in a civil matter that he was not totally forthcoming with. And when the vetters asked Governor Christie for more details about that, he did not provide them with what they thought of as adequate information. They asked him for more details about his health records. Governor Christie didn't provide what they thought of as adequate information about his health background, about his household help, and about his other lobbying clients. Those were a series of things that were not so much things that were in the public record, but that were things that they had questions about. And when Governor Christie was not as forthcoming with them as they expected him to be, and as every other one of the members of the people on the short list for vice presidential consideration were, their attitude was, Beth Myers, the woman who ran Governor Romney's vice presidential vetting team, her attitude was, she told her team, she said, if he's not answering questions, we should assume that the answers are bad. And so those are still question marks. They were question marks for Governor Romney. And again, another set of reasons why he didn't want any surprises. He didn't want to get in a situation where he put someone on the ticket and there were unanswered questions that would then come to the fore and distract the national press and distract voters away from his candidacy. And again, there are questions that are going to be raised, as Governor Christie knows and has said, if he decides to run in 2016.
I want to look at that. John Heilman and Mark Halperin with us. Double Down is the book. Let's go to our listeners, Bob in Wells River, Vermont. Bob, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Mark and John.
Oh, hey, thanks for having me. Hey, listen, listening to that speech by Christie last night, that was a very compelling speech. And, you know, my intuition is that he could very well be the candidate. And I'm having a hard time visualizing Clinton being able to sort of go toe-to-toe with him on the charisma front. And I know that's subjective, but I was wondering if you guys could comment on that.
Absolutely. Mark Halperin, can Chris Christie roll over the kind of red flags that you and others have put out there, that Romney's own camp put out there? I mean, do you picture a Clinton ad, you know, that goes right to Christie's Wall Street ties and Bernie Madoff connection? If it was a problem in 2012, is it a problem in 16? And what about the charisma standoff if it were Hillary versus Chris?
Well, Bob, you're asking me to start writing Game Change 3 right here, so I will.
Yes, we are.
First draft. You know, Chris Christie is an incredibly compelling guy, and he's a great leader. There are questions about his record in New Jersey. The unemployment rate is still high. Sometimes people find him a little bit too abrasive, to say the least, and that was another concern that some of Governor Romney's advisors had. So he's got his unique style, and there's questions about whether that style would play outside New Jersey. It plays at least for one listener here in Vermont. But, you know, what would Governor Christie be like in South Carolina or in other parts of the Republican base? I think that right now, today, there aren't too many other people who we talk about as potential candidates who have as good a chance to be the Republican nominee as Chris Christie. And I think if you think about it from the point of view of Hillary Clinton, assuming she runs and is a Democratic nominee, there aren't very many people who would be as formidable, just because he's not like very many other people in politics. Yes, like every candidate, he's got vulnerabilities, he's got flaws, he's got question marks. Can he get through the Republican nomination process? All those are big questions and germane questions. But just as a political talent with charisma who people find engaging, and that quality of someone who people like to have in their homes, who people find to be compelling, George Bush, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Ronald Reagan, all of them are compelling personalities. And while Hillary Clinton is a compelling personality in her own way, Chris Christie is about as compelling as anybody as you can find. And so I agree with the caller. He's got the potential, if he can navigate this, he's got the potential to be as formidable as anyone Hillary Clinton could face.
Mark Halperin and John Heilman write about the path that we've been on in 2012. Rico's calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Rico, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I believe Chris Christie has a repellent argument. Since the beginning, when the new media tried to speak about the comments he made in response to him putting his child, I believe, in private school, I believe he stands the things that he say. He always stay behind them, and he never changes. He's still the same person since then all the way to now. So I think he will be a good person to run for the next presidency, and I also would like to see Hillary Clinton in there also.
You'd like to see them both. What, you think Hillary would go well up against Chris Christie? Who knows? That may be what we get. But what about the Madoff stuff, the connection? For what it is, Mark, is that an ad that we're going to be looking at in 2015 in the run-up? And can Christie just roll over it?
I mean, I think, again, that's one thing where, as John said, the ad kind of writes itself. But there are other aspects of his background and his record in New Jersey and his temperament, that all of which would be fair game for Hillary Clinton or a super PAC associated with her. Governor Christie is a pretty tough guy. And again, not talking about his record in New Jersey, which has pros and cons, but just his personal style and his political skills. One thing I think people like about him, and he says this about himself, is he's confident and he really does. Politicians like to say, I mean what I say and I say what I mean. Chris Christie's darn good at that. And that fits the mood of the times for a lot of people. So I think if Chris Christie has negative ads, if he runs, and if he has negative ads run against him, either by other Republicans or by Democrats, I think you'll see a lot of fight back, a lot of pushback. And again, if he calibrates it right and the style is the appealing side of Chris Christie, he's a formidable force. When it verges into the unappealing, less so.
Tom, let me just say, I'll say one thing about the Hillary and Chris Christie comparison.
Yes.
The big difference between the two of them is Hillary Clinton is a national figure now. She has been Secretary of State. She was First Lady. She has been through a presidential campaign once before. Whatever you think about her politics, she's been around this track now once.
Yep.
And Chris Christie, although he has gotten a lot of national attention for a governor, has never done this before. And one thing that Mark and I have seen in our careers covering politics and in both of these books and Game game change and double down is that it makes a huge difference to have done this before and been on the national stage. You know, you think about a national figure, Rudy Giuliani, was the mayor of New York City, was the hero of 9/11, and as soon as he got on the national stage, crumpled like a paper doll in 2008. In 2012, Rick Perry, the longest serving governor in the history of Texas, had been reelected three times in Texas, was someone who a lot of people thought was perfectly tailored with the Texas economic story and his ties to the conservative base in the Republican Party. People thought he was charming and that he would make a great national figure. He fell apart very quickly, as we detail in Double Down, once he got into the national stage. I'm not predicting that for Chris Christie, but some governors, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, they make the transition almost flawlessly. Some governors who people think are going to make that transition easily, like Rick Perry, a mayor like Rudy Giuliani, again, some people who got a lot of national exposure, they fall apart almost immediately when they get on the big stage. So the thing that we will not see from Hillary Clinton is that kind of stumble. That doesn't mean she'll be a perfect candidate, but she knows what it's like to run for president, and she knows what it's like to compete on a different stage than Chris Christie's ever had to stride before.
I guess it looks to me like Christie's been out on more of a national stage than most, but let's hold that thought. One more right here on Christie, and we've got more to look at. Paul in Newton, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Very interesting discussion, but you've talked around a subject that possibly is politically incorrect, and that is you go from a fit, lean president like Barack Obama to anybody considering Chris Christie, who's round as a ball. You know, how about that? I haven't heard one word on that subject, and I think it would be important in the election consideration.
We'll pick it up right here. Mark Halpern, you report Mitt Romney certainly having his share of fat jokes, straight-up fat jokes on the campaign trail, and this not meaning nothing to him, even when it came to Christie. What about our big governor of New Jersey in Romney's mind, in the public's mind, if we go to 2016?
Well, Tom, I mean, look, he's had a lap band surgery since the presidential election, and he's lost some of weight. One of the things he guards zealously is how much exactly he weighs, but he's clearly thinner. Anybody go and look at before and after pictures from last fall versus this fall, and he's lost a fair amount of weight through the surgery. Look, the country is willing to elect heavy people. Governor Christie deals with
it's been a while nationally since.
Well, Bill Clinton would be happy to hear you say that.
Well, okay. Yeah, but there's a difference.
And Governor Christie, you know, is pretty compelling. He's been on David Letterman and elsewhere talking about his struggles with weight. He's talked about our friend Mika Brzezinski about it as well. I think that it's certainly an issue. There's no perfect candidates out there. You know, for all the concerns someone might have about Chris Christie's weight, you could talk about Jeb Bush having the last name Jeb, or Paul Ryan being so associated with cutting, or last name Bush rather, Paul Ryan being associated with cutting Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. There's no perfect candidates, and I think Chris Christie is pretty practiced in talking about his weight in a way that a lot of Americans find compelling. You know, for any candidate, you want to balance being accessible and seeming like an ordinary person with being a little bit, you know, regal and kind of magisterial and above it all.
Yeah.
And I think Chris Christie, on the regular person side, you know, how many people listen to this program now have ever struggled with their weight?
Oh,
almost
hey,
all of them.
Hey, absolutely.
Almost all of them.
But John,
and
just got a second.
It makes them accessible.
Mitt Romney on fat and fat jokes in Double Down. What have you got for us, John?
Well, Governor Romney's a very trim fellow, and he takes physical fitness very seriously. We report in the book that he found it kind of he was kind of fascinated in some ways by Chris Christie's size. He would sort of watch with interest as Christie tried to navigate his way down those narrow aisles of the campaign bus, and occasionally would make cracks about overweight women that he saw on the street to his campaign aides. He would say, "Oh, look, hey, there goes your date tonight." So Governor Romney, like some skinny people we know, maybe harbors a little bit of disdain for those who don't have the discipline that he has when it comes to fitness.
A little edge on Mitt Romney right there. John Heilman and Mark Halpern with us, co-authors of Double Down, Game Change 2012. Behind us, Mitt Romney's Born Free. Kid Rock singing, played at a lot of Mitt Romney events. This is On Point.
Tom Ashbrook.
Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with political reporters Mark Halperin and John Heilman about their new book, Double Down. We're looking at the 2012 campaign and 2013 and 2016. Game change. John and Mark's book on the 08 presidential campaign was made into a movie by HBO. A lot of attention there. Here's a scene from that HBO movie between McCain advisor Nicole Wallace, played by Sarah Paulson, and vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin, played in Game Change by Julianne Moore.
Why'd you make me do Katie Couric?
Did you get the coverage? Did you?
Are you there? Are you listening to me?
Yes, Governor, I'm here. Katie was a logical choice. She's been very fair to us this entire campaign.
You call that interview fair?
Yes, Governor, I do.
I certainly don't. She was out to get me from the get-go.
No, she wasn't. The interview sucked because you didn't try.
What do you mean I didn't try?
You didn't fight back like you did in the Charlie Gibson interview.
There was a lot of juice in that campaign. There's always a lot of juice, juicy detail on the presidential campaign trail. They've gone out for it again from the 2012 campaign. It is in Double Down, Game Change 2012. One of the things that they're reporting here is a conversation within the Obama camp on, on replacing Joe Biden as the VP candidate with Hillary Clinton. On Friday, Obama's former chief of staff, Bill Daley, spoke to CBS News This Morning about many of the reports in Double Down. He said that there was no serious discussion that Biden should be replaced as the vice presidential candidate. Here's Bill Daley.
Not for a moment was there a serious discussion or a belief that Joe Biden should be replaced, period. That doesn't mean issues were not looked at. Lots of issues in 2011 were looked at. Anybody who would have brought this idea into the president in the Oval Office, in my opinion, probably would have been thrown out immediately.
There's the denial, Mark Halperin. How serious, if serious at all, was the consideration of booting Joe Biden for Hillary Clinton on the ticket?
Tom, you know how reluctant I ever am to disagree with you, but I'm going to take some small exception here because okay. It really wasn't a denial of what we report in the book. You go back to the fall of 2011, the president was through the last round of big fighting over the deficit and the raising the debt ceiling. And he came out of that with a compromise, but one that made him look in the eyes of both Republicans and Democrats and a lot of people in the press weak. And his presidency was kind of at its low point. And his advisors really worried, no matter who the Republicans ended up nominating, that the president was facing a really uphill climb to get reelected. And so they can, as Bill Daley said, and as we report in the book, they considered a lot of things. One thing they wanted to look at was, would replacing Joe Biden with Hillary Clinton make a big enough difference for the president's chances that it would be worth the downside, which would be substantial in terms of the perception of weakness and panic? And so they did some research, a poll, to say, what if we added Hillary Clinton to the ticket? Would that do a lot better than Joe Biden? That was done by the White House chief of staff, by people like David Plouffe and David Axelrod at the top levels of the Obama campaign. That anything done at that level is serious. And that doesn't mean that they offered Hillary Clinton the job, and it doesn't mean that they ever took it to the president and said, we think you should do this. They did the poll. And what they found was that Hillary Clinton helped not enough to make it worth it. Really no difference. People tend to vote for the top of the ticket. Had that poll come back differently, have that poll showed that Barack Obama's political fortunes would be substantially improved if they'd made the change, there would have been at least another chapter in that story, I'm quite certain, given how perilous things were at that time for the president.
You say serious. Bill Daley says not serious. I mean, there's ways to debate that until the cows come home, I suppose. What about Barack Obama himself? What you found in your research for Double Down about moments of ambivalence by the president, but also his sense of this reelection as being his ultimate political challenge, and if he could pull it off, triumph. There are sometimes perceptions today, John Heilman, of an ambivalent, cool, distant president in the White House. How does your reporting reflect on the man we see in the White House in the middle of so much difficulty right now?
Well, I'd say a couple things about that, Tom. I mean, one is, again, brings us back to one of the things we discussed at the beginning of this conversation. You know, the president, you know, 2008 was a very colorful election. But in a lot of ways, after 8 years of George W. Bush and the time when a lot of Republicans even were sick of – were suffering from Bush fatigue and were sick of their own party, it was a relative cakewalk for a Democrat. Well, the big battle was who was going to be the Democratic nominee. The general election, though, was kind of in the bag, especially after the financial crisis in September of that year. This election was a much more hard-fought election in some ways, and Republicans were really energized. For much of 2010 and into 2011, the president and his team thought that they were at best a 50-50 proposition and possibly the underdogs because the economy was still not strong. Much of the country thought that the country was on on the wrong track. And President Obama felt that this was not going to be his winning now would vindicate his record, for one thing. And he was going to be facing an opposition that was much more feral than the opposition that he faced the first time around. And he thought it was essential for him to win because he believed that if he lost, Republicans would undo everything that he'd accomplished over the course of the first 4 years. So for him, the stakes were higher. And he said, and we report in the book on election night, that this was a more gratifying victory for him than his historic victory in 2008. That provides a lot of the drama that goes into Double Down, is the stakes involved for all the players, but particularly for President Obama. His ambivalence is reflected, has always been reflected in a lot of different ways, but you see it in this book quite clearly. He's a guy who cares a lot about the country and cares a lot about getting policy right. Mm-hmm. He feels he's dedicated to the job and he's dedicated to trying to do what he believes is in the best interest of the country. But he's also someone who does not have a lot of enthusiasm for many aspects of the job and much of the kind of political gamesmanship that is required of a successful president. And you see this throughout. We talked before about his kind of reticence about partaking in the political theater that was necessary to win those debates. Another example is in terms of raising money. You know, we report in the book kind of an astonishing thing. There's never been a Democrat who's raised more money than Barack Obama, and yet he tells his campaign manager, Jim Messina, in our book, he says he couldn't name the top five bundlers, his top five campaign fundraisers. Yeah. He couldn't name those people. Even though he knows he has to raise close to $1 billion to win, he's kind of indifferent to the process of doing it. And all these people who are out there raising all this money for him, he can't even really be bothered with getting to know them and have a first name kind of acquaintance with them. He's a guy who really on some level does not love the nuts and bolts of politics in the way of the practice of politics in the way that, say, Bill Clinton reveled in it.
A president of some distance, yes, with his own fundraisers there, certainly with congressional leaders. Here was President Obama at the White House Correspondents' Dinner in April of this year.
Of course, even after I've done all this, some folks still don't think I spend enough time with Congress. Why don't you get a drink with Mitch McConnell, they ask. Really? Why don't you get a drink with Mitch McConnell?
Mark Halperin, there's an echo right there of some of the Obama ambivalence that you report in Double Down. How do you think that's playing out in the consequences of that personality in the president's second term right now?
Well, Tom, I think historians are going to build on what our colleagues have written and what we write about in Double Down about the president and the implications of it. He has an attitude of he doesn't want to spend time with people he doesn't like. He doesn't like very many people. And a lot of the Republican congressional leaders, his view is he spent some time with them, not very much, but he spent some time with them, didn't change their attitude, and he's pretty much done with them. And I think that you can see from the way he ran for reelection in the last year of his first term, the way he pretty much gave up on both Mitch McConnell and John Boehner as partners to try to win over. He's left himself with the prospect, I believe, based on the reporting we've done for Double Down, that there's a possibility that he will go through this entire 4-year term not getting very much of consequence done because of Republican opposition to him, Republican intransigence, mm-hmm. and because he has not been able to successfully reach out. There's a lot of blame to go around, but the president's the one who's A, in charge, and B, said we should turn the country over to him because he knew how to have people get along. He's not been able to succeed there, and I think that the lessons of Double Down and the proof of the first few months of this new – the first year of this second term or almost a year of the second term is that the president is going to have to either win back control of the House of Representatives in the midterms, which is a tall order, or again, he faces the prospect of not having partners with the opposition in a way that could bring about real fundamental change to the kind the country not only wants but needs.
There's a piece of the Obama picture in 2012 and now. Let's turn to some of that Republican intransigence picture then and now. Ted Cruz, of course, huge in the government shutdown. Here he was at the Republican National Convention in Tampa, Florida. Mark Halperin and John Hellman report extensively on that in Double Down. August 2012, Ted Cruz addressing the hall.
Can we restore the Constitution? Yes, we can. Can we retake the Senate? Can we repeal Obamacare? Yeah. And can we defeat President Barack Obama? Yeah.
A lot of yeses there in the hall in Tampa. A lot of noes, as the reality turned out. What about this Tea Party figure? Of course, he then was fighting for his own seat in the Senate. He's made a very big splash once he got there. John Hellman, what about the Tea Party vibe running in the 2012 campaign season and how it's morphed since then, how it looks headed toward 2012, particularly after Chris Christie coming in with this big, hey, I'm the moderate Republican message in New Jersey?
Well, look, I mean, Tom, the Tea Party is obviously a new and incredibly important force, still relatively new and incredibly important force in American politics. You know, President Obama comes into office and has to deal with that force as it arises, largely in opposition to some of the things that he had to do or felt he had to do to rescue the economy, the stimulus and the efforts to bail out the auto industry and the spending that was entailed there, and then the health care law. So you see the Tea Party rise in 2010 and become a big force in Republican politics, shaping the nomination contest as we chronicle it in Double Down. You have a party that is split in half between what you could call the establishment wing of the party on one side and the populist Tea Party wing on the other side. And there are what the party needs is someone who can bring those two things together, the energy of the Tea Party with the money and the credibility of the establishment wing. And you end up with no candidate who actually can be that fusion candidate in 2012. And where the party ends up is in kind of a no man's land with Mitt Romney, a guy who neither the Tea Party respects or is enthused about, nor is the establishment. And one of the most extraordinary things in the book is the extent to which we report about how much the donor class and the elected officials in the Republican Party were never behind Mitt Romney. To many people, it was kind of seemed like Mitt Romney was the establishment choice. Not true. The establishment really wanted many other people to run. They wanted Haley Barbour to run, the former governor of Mississippi. They wanted Mitch Daniels, the former governor of Indiana. Some of them wanted Paul Ryan to run. And in fact, we report in the book that even as late as February of 2012, people as high up in the party as John Boehner were trying to lure in a new candidate because they saw Mitt Romney's weaknesses. All of those strains within the party are not only still with us in 2013 and still going to be with us as we head into 2016, but they're much deeper. And Ted Cruz is now the poster child for one side of the schism in that party that will need to be healed if the Republican Party is going to either A, win the White House, and then B, be a constructive governing force going into the future.
Mark Halperin, that no man's land that the GOP fell into with Mitt Romney in 2012 is kind of at the heart of the GOP side of your story. Do they risk going there again? They said never again after 2012, but here we've got still this big canyon. Is that risk still out there? How does somebody like Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, how do they factor into the calculus looking at 16?
As I think I suggested earlier, it's the biggest challenge either party faces now, Tom, I think politically, because it takes a great political talent under any circumstances to unite the disparate wings of our parties. This country is different than most other industrialized democracies, as everybody knows. We have two political parties, so they're crammed with people from even in these polarized times, the most conservative Democrat and the most liberal Democrat. There's going to be a pretty wide gap there. Same on the Republican side.
Isn't the GOP gap just dwarfing the Democrats' gap right now?
Yes, that's what I was going to say. It's always hard, but it's particularly hard now for the Republicans because at both the national level with the gap between somebody like a Ted Cruz and somebody like a Chris Christie, but also at the grassroots level. You have a lot of grassroots Republicans on the far right and the so-called Tea Party and others associated with the far right who are very active, very vocal, put a lot of pressure on Republicans and threaten them with primaries or beat them in primaries. But you also have a lot of moderate Republicans in this country, in New England and elsewhere, who don't want to give up on the party, a lot of the wealthy donors in the party and fundraisers in the party. And so it's a real challenge. I think one of Governor Romney's failures and one of the reasons he didn't win was he wasn't very good at uniting the two parts of the party, in part because he didn't have a particularly strong hold on either part. There's a lot of mistrust on the Tea Party wing because of health care in Massachusetts and other aspects of his background and record. But also a lot of the wealthiest donors, as John suggested before, wanted Chris Christie or Mitch Daniels or Haley Barbour. So Governor Romney was not the best person to unite the party, although the poll suggested he had a lot of support across the board in the party, mostly, I think, because of opposition to the president that was a unifying force. But the party needs someone who can do it on his or her own terms. And I think right now, one reason people are attracted to Chris Christie is because he looks like he has at least the potential to do that as compared to somebody like a Ted Cruz.
Amazing material in this book on Mitt Romney and the Mormon community. I mean, you say in here that non-Mormon Romney followers found the feud between him and John Huntsman an as impenetrable as a Tolkien subplot rendered in Elvish. And then you're reporting that it was John Huntsman's father who put Harry Reid onto the fact that Mitt Romney had all these tax issues that came out. There's one more piece of tape I want to listen to. This is recently Saturday, New York, Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer in Des Moines, Iowa, urging Hillary Clinton to run for president in 2016. Here's Schumer.
I am urging Hillary Clinton to run for president. And when she does, she will have my full and unwavering support.
Oh boy, that's early, and that is unalloyed. We've talked a lot about the GOP side. John Hyman, look at Hillary Clinton for a minute. Looking at everything you've seen in 08, in 16, where things stand now, do you see her aiming for the ticket or not?
You know, you can never tell what's going to happen, Tom. And there's a lot of things, particularly including both Clinton, the health of both Clintons, Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, that could stop her from running. But I think there's almost no one in the Democratic Party right now who doesn't think that she's planning to run. And I think that it will be hard, well nigh impossible to stop her from getting the Democratic nomination if she decides to run. She is an incredibly formidable figure. Largely because she will dominate the donor class and lock out almost anyone else from being able to raise enough money to be able to take her on, and the fact that she has the loyalty of so many women in the party. And there are so many female Democrats whose attitude was, it's time now. We've now finally nominated our first African-American nominee. It's time for our first female nominee. And the truth is, one of the most extraordinary things, again in Double Down, is the extent to which Hillary Clinton has become, after all the bitterness of 2008, Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton have become allies with the Obamas, Michelle and Barack Obama, in some ways part of the same big political family.
Mark Halperin, 5 seconds here before we've got to let you go. Christie Clinton, 16, who takes it, Mark?
The American people, Tom.
Good answer. Lots of juicy detail from Mark Halperin and John Heilman coming along behind the 2012 campaign. The book is Double Down, Game Change 2012. Mark, John, thanks very much for being with us today. Good luck to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.